Phil, there are so many great television shows and movies.
That's right. Thank goodness Resonance Rewind has the team to analyze them on a personal basis.
Mission Control, I got some news for you that's going to shock you, so you better sit down. Listen very carefully. The Earth is flat, gentlemen. That's right. It's flat as a table. Hey, wait a minute. There's an elephant holding up the table. And there's something holding up the elephant. Wait, it's a rhinoceros holding up the elephant. Hey, wait a minute. There's such a big cloud cover, I can't make out what's holding up the rhinoceros. Gentlemen, I don't know how to tell you this. I'm just going to have to come right out and say it. The table, the elephant, the rhinoceros are all being held up by a gorgeous 20-year-old girl. There goes the old ego. Probably one of the most surreal introductions ever to Resonance Rewind. So what is it all about? Is it mental illness? Is it simply a case of resuscitating an astronaut? Is it getting an astronaut back into space? Is it rescuing a chap who's suffering from mental illness? Is it all about the dolphins? Or is it even something more? Well, to discuss this first season episode of the $6 Million Man, of course, Burning Bright, originally back in 1974 when it first aired, we're delighted to welcome an all-American lineup for the joys of Resonance Rewind. I say all American because our British souls haven't been able to connect with the actual piece. And I must admit, I didn't think I'd set a task which was going to be insurmountable for some of the folk to actually access this season one episode. I think the best thing is, if you're this side of the Atlantic, get hold of the DVDs. That's the key thing. But we do have Jessica Burtis and Kathy Mann. So Jessica will be sharing her thoughts on the episode in a later part of this program. But Kathy, what did you make of William Shatner and Lee Majors in the same episode and the changes of tracksuit? I mean, I think Lee was wearing blue tracksuits. He was wearing safari outfits. He was wearing red tracksuits. He clearly had the red, white, and blue. Bill Shatner, of course, as Josh Logan, was wearing turquoise tracksuits. And I mean, it was a tour de force in terms of just the wardrobe alone, surely, for William Shatner and Lee Majors.
I mean, I also noticed when it was the focus of the introduction credits, right, where they just zoom in on him running, him in his tracksuit, all in red, slowly taking it inch by inch. So, yeah, tracksuits are definitely the focus here. But it was fun to see them interact with each other. I mean, I'm always excited when I get to see William Shatner, you know, and I've never seen this, so this was new for me. It was a roller coaster, though, personally for me. Because I enjoyed the introduction. I liked that the first scene was, you know, him in space being an astronaut and, and you know, cute jokes, things like that. I enjoyed it. And then the trauma, the event happens.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the actual original footage, and I must admit, I think even at the time, I felt a little bit. I think they missed a trick because I actually had the real life footage of Ed White, genuine American space hero, who sadly died in one of the first Apollo aspects, and he was there. But then the studio cut to William Shatner clearly in a studio. Just didn't work. Yeah, it just didn't quite work for me. It was almost as though they decided, oh, let's just make it like Capricorn One. Let's just make it a complete fictitious aspect. I mean, that's a stylistic thing, obviously. And again, it's something to be discussed in terms of that. But having said all of that, for me, I did feel that the dynamic worked well, and certainly some of those underlying issues relating to mental health, because ultimately this is what Josh is going through, that basically he can be grounded on the basis of he's always been a bit wacky. He comes out with strange lines and strange aspects from that point of view. But this is something where clearly it's a case of, well, actually he's suffering from mental illness.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I mean kind of with what I mean when I say it was a roller coaster, because there were moments that I was like, wow, this is really good. And then there were moments where they were losing me and I was like, oh, I don't think I like this. And well, and like his opening line, or maybe not one of his opening lines, but at the beginning, he makes the joke of, guys, the earth is flat. And it's appreciated and it's quirky. And I think exactly what you're saying, it's this introduction into mental illness, especially during a time where it really wasn't a focus, you know? I mean, they barely were allowing women the exception of postpartum depression, let alone this. So it is quite, it is a little futuristic even for them in that sense of, oh, actually, this contributes to someone's personality. This doesn't mean that it's wrong or bad. It's something more about them. And depending on the support they get will determine the outcome, which I think is something we learn immensely in mental health. Believe me, I did, because today was my first of 2 days of mental health first aid. So very appropriate for me to
It
be watching this.
shows the synchronicity you see between Resonance Rewind, a show which is nearly 50 years old, and obviously people's current experiences, which is fantastic. Lots of interesting lines that the journey takes us on. Obviously, it was written by Del Reisman. I wasn't familiar tremendously with his backdrop, but directed by Jerry London. We certainly that whole notion of the underlying themes partly were going to be revisited in Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home, this notion that dolphins can be a connection between ourselves and extraterrestrials, or indeed to find out what's out there. And this sense of adventure that clearly Will Shatner, who was at this stage undeniably, he was Captain Kirk, and this was clearly he was a guest star as a spaceman, and I can understand that whole aspect within that. But his take and his manic performance probably echoes his earlier work in The Twilight Zone, which again we'll bring in Jessica here because back in the days of William Shatner and of course his classic Twilight Zone episodes, one of which we've actually looked at before, where he kind of is having a nervous breakdown and he goes through that particular pattern as well. I mean, I know you're having a look at the episode in its entirety, Jessica, before this Resonance Rewind has actually ended, so it'll all slot together perfectly. But what are your kind of thoughts when you realise that from what Kathy said, from what I said, that this is one of the sort of areas where we do see Bill Shatner as, of course, astronaut Josh, but also going through this mental trauma.
I think it's interesting that there is such a highlight on this, especially since, like Kathy pointed out, this time period isn't, I'd say, particularly known for being very open about mental health. And I do think it's interesting to see a lot of his roles connected with like space or the unusual, the fantastic, then also grounded through something like mental health and the mind, because I think whether it's space in Star Trek or something crazy happening in the Twilight Zone, or this, where again space is involved, like they're all still connected by something that everyone can relate to and can understand, even in these fantastic roles.
When I first saw this, I initially thought, oh, there's really only one female character in it, and that's Millie the waitress. Actually, I was wrong, of course, because there is the computer programmer. So there actually is indeed, right? And of course, it is the computer programmer who has to cope with the notion that there was a variable in the curl pattern, which frankly, even now, and I did pure mathematics, I still am not quite sure. I understand variables, but I'm not sure about the variable in the curl pattern, or indeed the notion of the sun being the center of vector space, etc. To use the classic line, this of course ignores the elasticity of the Earth's elliptical orbit around the sun, which it's clearly there. Now, I wasn't sure whether that was technobabble or that was delving deep into it, but I did certainly connect with the dolphins and the mathematical way in which Josh's character summons them, communicates with them, gets them to leap up as one, and then two, and then four. And clearly, if they'd gone for geometrical progression, they would have gone to eight. So there was this mathematics that was actually based within that. How did you feel, Kathy, that relationship between nature and humanity was being portrayed? Because clearly there were issues relating to come to the place which is calm, peaceful. And Josh, of course, he goes to this ocean center because it's the one place that he actually feels genuinely calm, that, you know, there aren't any telephones to answer, that peaceful place that's actually there. There aren't any money worries. Again, I wasn't sure, is this at the end of the sort of the 60s era, or is it a case of, again, what you're addressing there is this whole notion of actually sometimes there's far too much stuff there, and all that stuff just leads to craziness.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that they chose dolphins, because there's already been tremendous studies and research with the intelligence of dolphins and exactly what they were focusing in the film, how they communicate and the signals and ways, which has been proven, and not just with dolphins, other marine-like animals as well. But, and also the correlation of water and space is easy to see, you know? I mean, these are two spaces that aren't very well explored, for obvious reasons. We only know 5% of the ocean, and that's being generous. You know, we're learning something about marine biology literally every day that doesn't make headline news, but it's still impressive. I mean, I think the last thing I read was we have an alarming amount of giant squids in the ocean, and we have absolutely no idea. And the only reason we know there's an alarming amount of giant squids in the ocean is because they are the prey of a certain dolphin, whale, I can't remember which one, and they can count how often they eat giant squids. And it's those kind of facts and insanity that adds the interest to it. So I did appreciate that, especially since like a lot of astronaut training has to take place in the ocean, you know, to give that similar kind of concept. So I think making it a place of reflection and ease for the character made complete sense. I think my criticism comes a little bit with dolphins aren't as nice as we think, especially if you research them. They're kind of bullies. Actually, they are bullies. And they probably will not save you if you're in the ocean. You never know. There's been stories. And I also probably have a lot of beef with the cinematography, really against the cinematography in this.
There were some interesting, again, production choices made. Of course, this was also on the back of what in American television was one of the finest series ever, of course, Flipper, which was, I suppose, the best PR dolphins could ever actually have had. I mean, if you actually were to actually say that if Steven Spielberg's movie Jaws was the worst PR ever for the shark world, then Flipper obviously did the flip side of that as far as dolphins are concerned. But
and the irony is, you would rather be next to a shark than a dolphin.
It's an interesting point to ponder, but people do swim with dolphins as well, of course. From that, how did we feel, Kathy, about Andy? Because this was again something which took us off on a whole different line, and obviously Josh climbing up the power towers, discovering Steve's bionics. There were areas there was a sequence actually again, and I thought, oh, I hope they don't end it there. I could understand a directorial decision for saying let's end it here, where Steve effectively carries the body of Josh just goes on carrying, and I just think, where's he going? Where is he actually going with Josh's body? But at the same time, that there was a sense of how those things worked. And of course, Andy Arusa and the, is it a MacGuffin? Where we find out that this is the legacy, or this is where Josh has effectively arranged for an insurance payment to go, because of course, you know, Andy was somebody that even Josh has forgotten about. or claims to have forgotten about. But then that takes us off into a whole other story in terms of the guilt fact that comes there, that, you know, a childhood friend who lost his life, which brings us to the pylons as well. I mean, even as a B story, that didn't quite work for me.
Yeah, I think the only way what I took away from it was, like, you could see Josh's villain story beginning, I guess, you know, like, oh, wow, look how impressive. think about all the things you can do. And you're like, uh-oh, that this could be for good or for bad. Whoa. and I mean, that's really what it is. You know, any form of new technology, I think that's kind of what it brings up, is really dependent on the person using it. And it can go either way, you know, and that's what I took a lot from that scene. But yeah, I had the same concern. I thought that was the end. And I was like, we just started. And thankfully, gracefully, depending on your definition of gracefully, we come to find out, no, that's not the case. And I think that's because I think that's what this is, where I'm probably not going to give this a very high score. I'm not going to give it a low score. I'm going to be fair in my scoring. But this is where the roller coaster kind of really shows the example of, there are some really solid moments where you can see, oh, great, I really like this chemistry and this interaction. But how they're portraying it, it loses you. And I think, like, there were moments as I was watching this, I wasn't as invested as I should have been, you know? And yeah, so that's kind of my take on that.
There is an argument that lots of fans have said that this also foreshadows, as I've already said, Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home, where we also deal with whales, who obviously are needed to actually rescue the planet Earth, Grace and Gertie. We'll talk about that in months to come. And of course, it also echoes in terms of the first season episode of Star Trek, Where No Man Has Gone Before, in which Kirk's best friend, Gary Mitchell, is impacted electronically by the galaxy barrier and reaches godlike powers and so on. And of course, Josh does kill somebody in this particular instance. It's unfortunate, but, you know, he does actually kill from that point. So maybe there was a sense that he needed to work through that. The dynamic, though, yes, I tend to agree. For me, one of the saving graces was the music. I thought the music and the otherworldliness that Ollie Nelson and company had actually put together in this had really echoed. And I think it managed to provide that sense of otherness that really helped enhance the actual piece. Whilst at the same time, again, opening up the sort of range of how things were going, et cetera.
I also really like that you used the word echo, because you know what else echoes? Dolphins.
Of course, exactly. This is true. This is, yeah, the script that we work together very much addresses that side of things there. You talked about Andy Arusa, obviously, or Mr. Arusa, and the line within that whole field. We talked about the notion of iced tea, that Jessica, you'll be pleased to know, iced tea does actually make an appearance in this episode. Not sweet tea, but iced tea is actually there. In, of course, the Blue Velvet Cafe feature, where effectively Josh is in the sort of the third act of the whole thing. And finally, that sort of three-act structure, which many people would say is the best way forward. Some people would say you can't formularize on this. I mean, again, I thought there were some nice outs with respect to that. I thought the escape that Josh's character had from his confinement, his hospital bed, etc., and the nod to camera where he says just don't fall asleep. I thought that worked quite nicely. Any other sort of highlights in terms of characters? Because we are coming around to that notion where I'll be asking you, at least Kathy, at this stage, for your favorite characters.
Other things that I'd like to point out. There were definitely some solid quotes. I definitely don't want to like point completely, you know, I'm not looking here to have a bad time with it. I was going in it with an open mind. And there were definitely a lot of aspects I liked. I guess, you know, when I think it's this conversation with Steve Austin and Oscar Goldman where he's like, there's a mistake in the computer program. And he goes, and his son as the origin of space theory. He's like, completely valid. I've got all the printouts. you know, like you have.
And the cost that Oscar actually had to say two computer runs. I mean, the cost was ridiculous to actually get those checked out.
Ridiculous. So I definitely really appreciated some of the language that was being used. I I think as a favorite character, well, obviously you got to give a shout out to the dolphins, and the iced tea, of course. They get honorable mentions, but
Again,
it's
to quote Josh Lang, do you realize what we could learn if we could send one of these dolphins up into space into that electrical field? Why, there's no mystery in the universe that you and I couldn't solve. Again, earlier, with your bionic strength and my far-out brain, we're superior types. Think about it, Steve. We're the beginning of a whole new species. Again, lots of sort of enthusiasm, lots of dynamism, lots of approach from that point of view there. Maybe they just needed to compress it again into what is a longer than average TV episode, about 50 minutes for the time, so allowing for commercial breaks and so on. But again, like yourself, Kathy, no, didn't quite connect on that basis. And Josh, is his character sympathetic? Possibly not, ultimately, from
What
my
would
own
you
point of view.
diagnose him with? If, I mean, I know we're not here to diagnose people. That's not very cool. Just a shout
Well,
out. But because we are talking about mental illness, and he is a fictional character, what would you diagnose him with?
there was initially a notion of ADHD or attention deficit disorder, where you tend to think maybe he, but then obviously he's an astronaut, and of course this is the other area where at the time and even now there's still that question mark that has been raised about astronauts in the Apollo program, and there is a lovely mention which I thought was a really good grounder about Josh's attempt to get a dolphin up into space to actually go up with Steve Austin for the Apollo Soyuz program. Again, the first real collaboration between the two major space powers in the early 1970s before NASA had its budget cut and all the other sort of elements worked through that. But this sense that when astronauts went into space, and lots of astronauts have actually commented that they have actually been changed, that they've gone through that psychological perspective. Dare I say it, coming right up to date to, well, almost right up to date to 2020s, Bill Shatner himself, his response when he went up with the blue Amazon rocket with Jeff Bezos, again, said that he was specifically changed about that. So, again, lots of intriguing ways in terms of that. It'd be interesting to see whether William Shatner, the actor, could ever actually speak to Josh Lang, the astronaut, and see whether their views were similar. But there we are. That's another point. I don't know if that answers your question, Kathy, about what would I diagnose him with. I mean, I think a tragic figure, ultimately, somebody who clearly touched the greatness, a bit like the ancient Greek sort of notion of flying too far to the sun, was burned by the
Icarus.
sun. And Icarus, and you had that literal burning bright, which I think there was a movie, if memory serves, that John Travolta also did, where one of the signs of this particular mental illness was that suddenly, like a light bulb becoming too bright just before it goes out completely. That's the kind of line that he received from that point of view. Jessica, you've heard Kathy and myself talk about it. It's a slightly different sort of approach in terms of Resonance Rewind for this, because you're just about to go and immerse yourself, dolphin-like, in terms of the whole sequence and ready for that. Does this kind of pique your interest, or is it a case of, I don't know, because I know your parents were big $6 Million Man fans.
Oh yeah, no, it does. I'm very interested to see how all of this connects. We got space, we got dolphins, we got mental health. I'm like, we are all over the place. So I'm interested to see how this is all brought together. And yes, of course, like my parents will be happy. Dad still adores $6 Million Man. And, I'm sure he'll be very proud that I'm going to watch this.
And a season one episode as well, long before we get into Jamie Summers and the Bionic Woman and lots of other key areas. Okay, Kathy, I'm going to show. I think I said, yeah. I mean, I'm struggling because initially I had this at 7 to 7.5. Do you know? I might even go, because of the sign of infinity, I might even go 8. But I suspect you're going to be a lot lower, Kathy.
It's a solid 6 for me.
Thank you. So there we have it. Next week, a look ahead before we actually hear Jessica's views on Burning Bright from $6 Million Man. We will be exploring time and space once again, in which we will hopefully finally be able to connect with Matthew Jacobs, the writer of Doctor Who, the movie, Paul McGann version, which actually takes us to the cusp of the millennium and explains how, in essence, we all managed to survive the millennium thanks to the work of the Good Doctor, which is all good. Music by Oliver Nelson, but let's find out the important thing about this particular example of Resonance Rewind, of course, Burning Bright, in case you've forgotten. What did Jessica Burtis make of this particular season one episode of The $6 Million Man?
I enjoyed it. I think a lot of the episodes I've seen of The $6 Million Man were very action-packed, and they had a lot of those stunts in it. And this one was a little bit more introspective. I like that we still saw some of the stunts and things. I love the sound effects that always accompany the jumps. It's great. And I also thought it was interesting that he was kind of like, he guessed that he had bionic abilities, because I don't know if it was kind of like a bit of a secret from the beginning episodes and then like progressed, because it didn't seem like he was like going to tell him, oh, they're like bionics just outright. So I wonder if that's like an interesting part of the show that, since it says, I guess, later in season one, that was a development. It was good to see how the dolphins in this space all tie together and everything kind of coalesced. And I thought it was a very interesting exploration of just the human mind and how it was taken too far in this for this one individual. And I also think it's kind of interesting to, at least for me, it kept reminding me of like post-traumatic stress disorder that people might face when they've come back from an experience that nobody else really knows how to kind of handle or has experienced themselves, kind of like how he dealt with the trauma of this childhood friend he had, who he saw die. And it made me wonder if astronauts like have small groups where they meet and just like talk about being in space and like that experience, because nobody else in the world can relate to that and how otherworldly that must feel. Literally, literally otherworldly.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are not necessarily support groups, but I think it's fair to say that given that our current period in history, there are, as far as we know, only 12 human beings who've ever set foot on the moon. That certainly is shared experience. I mean, sadly, not all are with us. I mean, Neil Armstrong obviously passed away. Buzz Aldrin is still around. And that opening sequence that we saw of the genuine astronaut, who sadly again was a victim of the Apollo space program, I think ties in that aspect. And you're right. I mean, initially, I think we have this sequence, which I almost initially I thought, well, was this just padding? Because the first 3 or 4 minutes, once we start the actual episode, we get that wonderful hook, then we get the credits, and then of course we get what seems to be about 3 to 4 minutes of Steve Austin doing bionic stuff, running at 66 miles an hour, obviously going through a kind of checkup system, and all of those aspects of the discussion about how Oscar Goldman says, well, it's he uses it on instinct. Of course, that's something that maybe the portrayal of Lee Majors at a time, we must never really forget that this is a person who's lost both his legs, one arm, and one eye. I mean, he's a huge paraplegic, having to actually come on board with the whole bionic essence. And I think that interconnection, and you're right, Jessica, because clearly one of the aspects and the involvement of the Office for Strategic Investigations or Scientific Investigations, OSI, was it was a top secret classified project that effectively is known. And yet you do have the recognition that Josh kind of identifies that clearly the fact that Steve Austin is able to actually rescue him from being electrocuted from the tower clearly connects with other sort of areas as well. So I think it was quite, I wouldn't say subtly, but it was interestingly put together in terms of how that was developed. Any other points that you thought were particularly interesting from either the discussion you heard in the early part of the show or indeed other areas? I mean, you mentioned the dolphins. What about the Millie, the long-suffering barmaid who obviously panics and quite understandably has a police officer friend? He dies because his heart stopped.
Yeah, I feel like this show like featured a lot of like traumatic events and people witnessing someone suffering and then having to kind of cope with the fallout of that. And it was emotional seeing her so upset. And also I think kind of like, you know, it made me think of Josh and his experience in childhood and seeing someone die and then like that cycle kind of getting repeated onto someone else. And I think that it was like one of those situations where he's not a bad person. He's just like somebody struggling. And it got out of hand. And it was very poetic, that scene to me of the bionic man like carrying him down, and just holding him. And I think that again, like how we were talking about, they both have experienced traumatic things, and they both probably feel like, I don't know, in my mind, like very isolated. How he was kind of saying, we're a new race. Like they've both experienced things that make them very different from other people, and that nobody else can really understand. And now he's carrying like his friend, who was like someone experiencing something also singularly unique, and who. It just became too much to handle, and how that might have made the $6 million man think in his own mind. You know, like I wonder if he was his character, I imagine, would be thinking also the same of like, is it going to go too far with him as well? Can he handle this massive responsibility? And if he was feeling isolated at all, so I really liked that final shot of him looking at the moon. I thought that was pretty beautiful, and how it kind of started and ended with. Something greater than Earth.
I think we've looked at a couple of previous episodes, The Pioneers, also I think the first episode of season two, and of course The Rescue of Athena One, which starred Lee Majors' then wife, Farrah Fawcett Majors. I think an interesting thing from the star system here is obviously 1974, Star Trek was popular, but it was no means the phenomenon that it became a few years later. It really wasn't until the 80s that Star Trek probably became a bona fide cultural phenomenon that really became a cash cow, if you like, for Paramount Pictures. So we have here again a jobbing actor, as he was at the time, very much William Shatner, but connected with Lee Majors in a way in which, as we said, both taking on board traditional white male Hollywood leading roles. Did you feel that they actually managed to address that quite nicely? Because, of course, as you said, astronauts were very much the heroes of the 60s and 70s period.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that I don't even expect the shows to address. I think it's kind of something that I just always have in my mind when watching this, is that there's a very specific demographic that is usually portrayed, you know, and like watching them talk. I remember thinking when I was watching the show, I was like, these two look like your classic just front runners of a show from the 60s, 70s, 80s, that they like filled that role completely. Both of them just seem like that. And how that's like kind of the figure that my dad grew up seeing, you know, and like in his shows. And if it were to be made today, I think it would be very different. You know, it would have a different cast. But I know later there was the Bionic Woman. And I think that was something that, you know, it was kind of ahead of its time. And I don't think that you see women, especially in like physical roles, a ton in a lot of early shows, but I know that that's part of this kind of world, the series.
Certainly, somewhere down the line, we'll be looking at Lindsay Wagner and, of course, the two-part episode written by friend of Resonance Rewind, Kenneth Johnson, of course, who was responsible for creating the Bionic Woman, amongst many other things they actually put together. So we could also talk a little bit about the backroom supporting cast, Richard Anderson as Oscar Goldman, of course, the other characters are actually based within that. I mean, the show revolves, if you exclude the dolphins, very much around Josh and Steve, undoubtedly. Were there any characters that you think actually, yeah, that connected with me?
I think I was very focused on the two main characters. I think the woman at the bar who was crying, like just seeing like the actress crying, it actually typically that doesn't affect me very much in movies. But it was just like these two men don't really seem to get emotional over their trauma in this episode, but then she was, and she was able to like show that sadness and the grief, and I feel like that was like a very vulnerable side. But otherwise, I was fond of Josh, and I think that also like Steve, he's such a likable character because he's always like he never belittled Josh over his experience. He was just understanding and just wanted to help his friend. And I don't think he ever looked down on him. I think he just had a lot of care. And I feel like that was very, like conveyed very well. I feel like you could feel that.
For me, one of the strengths of the episode is that it is self-contained. It's within 45, 50 minutes. I'm not sure. I mean, I know that there was discussion about a movie starring, of course, Mark Wahlberg as what would have been the $6 billion man, allowing for inflation, which has never quite manifested. But I think probably Wahlberg wouldn't. I mean, he would probably be a useful choice in terms of contemporary lines to work with that. But I do feel as though it was very much a rounded episode, and it worked on that basis. Maybe the temptation to spread it over two or three episodes, or indeed a whole six-part miniseries, would probably be taken these days, but for what it was, I felt it was a good example as well of, at this side of the Atlantic, we'd say the stiff upper lip. We'd probably say just effectively sucking it up and being masculine, or aspects with respect, or actually sort of working through that, which has got its positives as well as its negatives and challenges within that. So it'd be interesting to see again how the characters would be used and viewed in a contemporary scenario. But the time has come, Jessica, for your particular score.
Ah.
So, as you know, I think Kathy was on a six, I believe. I went for an eight. Where are you going to go for?
I think I'm actually going to give it an 8.5 because I really enjoyed it. And I feel like, kind of like how you're saying today, they would make this a long series. I feel like something that was kind of older television shows did well was knowing when to stop and when to kind of keep something like it was. Even if you want to know more, that's it. And I think that, like I said, they began and ended the show with showing space. And I feel like that was perfect little bookends. And I'm very satisfied with the episode. I also hope the dolphin actors were treated very well. I hope they were good on set.
It's fair to say we can, with confidence, say, Jessica, that no dolphins are ever harmed in any of the productions of Resonance Rewind, despite
Perfect.
Kathy's attempts to effectively say they've just had better PR than the sharks. So there we are, worth sorting through. Okay, so to Kathy Manso and Jessica Burtis, we'll say it again. Keep on resonating.
Stronger, faster.